Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We continue with our coverage from the 2021 National Association of Farm Broadcasters annual meeting. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack met with us virtually at the meeting. I will be reporting on that, but we start with today's news. The Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army announced a proposed rule to re-establish the pre-2015 definition of the waters of the United States. The agency planned to update the rule that's been in place for decades to reflect consideration of Supreme Court decisions. The action will advance the agency's goal of establishing a WOTUS definition that protects public health, the environment, and downstream communities. At the same time, the new rule would support economic opportunity, agriculture, and other industries that depend on clean water. With a growing number of dairy producers looking to maximize calf value through a beef-on-dairy cross, two breed associations are providing game-changing resources. The partnership offers a list of Sim Angus beef sires well-suited to enhancing marketability of beef-on-dairy calves. Miles Ramsey reports.
Nebraska dairyman John Steffen says he loves dairy farming because every day is a new challenge and a new opportunity, too. On his Steph View Dairy near Hardington, Steffen is adding another layer of revenue by marketing beef on dairy calves.
For my bottom line, it's another way to spread your eggs into more than one basket. It's another form of revenue for me. It helps improve my bottom line because we're adding value to something that we don't need as a replacement heifer.
To guide his breeding decisions, Steffen uses Wholesome, a partnership between Holstein Association USA and American Simmental Association. The program identifies Sim Angus bulls most complementary to a Holstein female to produce a more profitable terminal calf.
So Holstein Association has a list of Wholesome sires that they recommend makes a good cross beef on dairy. We follow those guidelines. We've been very pleased with those sires. It seems like we get a calf that that gains well, a calf that's born light birth weight, calf that can convert your feed.
Bulls qualifying for the Wholesome list are specifically selected to maximize profitability for beef on dairy crosses by focusing on traits like calving ease, grading ability, ribeye size, and a sensitivity to carcass length. Steffen has marketed more than 60 head of Wholesome calves to date, all about 800 pounds, and he says they've sold for prices comparable to straight black calves.
They're easy to sell. I take them to the stockyards on the day that they have their beef sale. They typically bring a premium, and so they sell right with the best of the Black Angus cattle.
Because of the success they've seen, Steffen says he would recommend this approach to fellow dairy producers.
It's peace of mind knowing that when you take a group of calves to town, you're going to be able to sell them and make some money on them. That gives me a sense of pride, not only in growing a nice looking group of calves, but in knowing that you're going to be able to come home with a check that's going to go to the bank and pay some bills for you.
Visit HolsteinUSA.com to learn more and view the latest Wholesome sire listing. For Holstein Association USA, I'm Miles Ramsey.
Deere & Company employees brought their five-week-old strike to an end by approving a new six-year contract with the company. United Auto Workers members were immediately prepared to return to their shifts with the agricultural and construction equipment manufacturer. The Des Moines Register says 61% of the workers approved the agreement, which raises hourly wages by 10% and increases worker retirement benefits. The company also agreed to maintain its health insurance program that employees don't have to pay premiums for. Just over 10,000 in number, the workers in Iowa, Kansas, and Illinois had rejected two prior contract proposals, setting off the first strike at Deere since 1986. The cost of a Thanksgiving Day meal is higher than last year. Chad Smith has more behind the rising price of the holiday feast.
A holiday meal with family and friends is a highlight for families across the country. But this year, that meal might be a little more expensive, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. AFBF senior economist Veronica Nye says shoppers should expect to pay a little over $50 this year.
This year, the average price that our shoppers found when they went to the grocery stores all across the United States was $53.31. That is a feast for 10 with plenty of room for leftovers. It includes Thanksgiving staples like turkey, pumpkin pie, whipping cream, dinner rolls, cranberries, green beans, whole milk, frozen peas, a veggie tray consisting of carrots and celery, and miscellaneous ingredients to enjoy the meal.
Despite the 14% increase from the 2020 average of $46.90, Nye says the price per person is still low.
This is less than $6 per person, despite the fact that we saw a 14% increase in 2021 relative to 2020. That's obviously a sizable increase, and I think it's important to break that down just a little bit. The overall Thanksgiving market basket, about 45% of the cost is related to the cost of turkey. So when we take turkey out, the average increase in the cost of all the other ingredients was about 6.6% relative to 2020.
Nye points out that Farm Bureau shoppers check prices between October 26th and November 8th. That's about 2 weeks before most grocery store chains began their turkey markdowns for Thanksgiving. However, that isn't the only factor impacting the higher cost this year.
Overall inflation in the U.S. economy at over 6.2% is certainly adding to the cost of all products in the U.S. economy, not just food products. We've seen unprecedented changes in consumer behavior, in supply chains, in all facets of U.S. life. So one of those elements is that once the pandemic began, we saw a significant shift in more consumers eating a larger share of their food at home versus away from home. That has an impact on food prices.
More information is available at www.fb.org/newsroom. Chad Smith, Washington.
That's our news for today. We will be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Welcome back. I was at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual meeting in Kansas City last week. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was one of our guests, and I have audio from his session now.
And I'm certainly thankful for the opportunity to actually be with you today. Certainly consider it an honor to be with those who provide an opportunity for messaging out to farmers, ranchers, forestry landowners, and those who live, work, and raise their families in rural communities across America about what's going on in their government. And I'm obviously very thankful that you all are able to meet in person. That wasn't something that we necessarily could do a year ago, but we are able to do that today, and we're able to look forward to a Thanksgiving holiday where we can be with our families in person, and that's certainly something to be thankful for. I'm certainly thankful for commodity prices being better today across the board than where they were a year ago. I'm thankful for the fact that agricultural exports also improved from last year and in fact set a record for this fiscal year and are on pace potentially to set yet another record next year. I'm certainly thankful for the extraordinary work of a lot of good people to get out pandemic relief to our farmers, ranchers, and producers. Over $6 billion has already been distributed with more to come before the end of this year. Those same hardworking folks at FSA offices across the country have also been responsible for, and I'll get this, being responsible for also providing over $14 billion in loans to farmers, ranchers, and producers, roughly 27,000 loans have also been funneled through that system in addition to the pandemic assistance. So I'm very thankful for the extraordinarily hardworking folks there, and also the NRCS folks who themselves, during this pandemic-stricken year, were able to provide 43,000 conservation contracts, impacting 21 million acres. So farm families across the country being able to invest in conservation. And I'm excited. I'm excited about what's next and what's up, what we can do over the course of the next several months at USDA. We're looking forward to taking advantage of the relief that Congress recently passed with a continuing resolution establishing a $10 billion fund for assistance for those who have been stricken by drought and for floods and fires and a variety of natural disasters. I spoke with Senator Hoeven and Senator Baldwin earlier this week and encouraged, they were encouraging me, and I was reassuring them that it was our goal to make sure that these resources were provided as quickly as possible. Hopefully we're able to get the framework of this program out before the end of the year or the first part of next year, and hopefully maybe be able to make payments sometime in February. That's what we're shooting for. I'm excited about what we're doing in the Climate Smart area. As you know, we launched the Climate Smart Agriculture and Forestry Partnership Initiative, which we believe is going to provide an opportunity to create climate smart commodities, higher value proposition for farmers and producers, an opportunity as well to benefit from ecosystem markets that are being operated in the private sector so that we increase and expand market opportunities and income opportunities for farmers. I'm looking forward to launching that and the framework of that again later this year, the first part of next year, and hopefully being able to make decisions about pilot projects we'll be funding in the first or second quarter of 2022. Excited about what we're doing on the supply chain side, getting prepared to announce the loan guarantee program that's going to expand opportunities for storage and warehousing. At the same time, looking forward to launching our effort to expand processing capacity and also to provide additional resources for existing processing facilities so that they too can expand. Very excited about what we're going to be able to do with the recently passed infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure bill. The expansion of broadband is certainly potentially could make your lives easier by expanding access to rural remote areas for high-speed broadband and all of the benefits that that will bring to farmers who are interested in precision agriculture, to hospitals who are interested in telemedicine, to school teachers who are interested in distance learning, to business owners who are interested in market expansion. And I'm looking forward to the passage by Congress of the Build Back Better legislation, which will provide an historic and unprecedented investment in both conservation and in forestry that would allow us to significantly ratchet up our efforts in helping farmers adjust to and mitigate to the impacts of a changing climate. So there's a lot to talk about, a lot to be excited about, a lot to be thankful for. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, and I'm more than happy to turn it back to you, Hale, so that whatever questions there are, I'll try to be able to answer them in the time we've got left.
We'll be right back with more.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. We continue with Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. NAFB President Gail Cunningham kicked off the question and answer session.
Secretary of Agriculture, I'm going to ask you first. I'm going to kind of get the ball started, and then we'll open it up for others. Robert Bonney was just confirmed by the Senate Agriculture Committee as a huge role under Secretary. when that is filled, how's the rest of the undersecretary staff and your staff coming together for you then, Tom?
Well, we're in pretty good shape in terms of the farm production and conservation mission area. We've got a deputy undersecretary in place. We have an administrator in place. We have a chief of staff in place. So Robert basically fills out the senior team in that mission area. We have obviously a chief of the NRCS as well that's been appointed, as well as additional staff people assisting Terry Cosby. So that team is in very good shape. We're excited about the team we put together at Rural Development with Undersecretary Torres Small now in place. We're hopeful that we soon get Dr. Homer Wilkes confirmed in the NRE position to basically oversee the operation of the Forest Service. We're excited about the opportunity in food safety recently announced. And so our team is filling out, which is good. We still have some vetting to be done in a couple of areas, but I anticipate and expect before not too long that we're going to basically have an entire slate of nominees presented to the Senate, and hopefully they get through the process quickly.
Very good. Next question.
Good afternoon, Secretary. Jody Heemstra, DRG Media Group, Pierce, South Dakota. On the line of your staff and getting folks in place, South Dakota is still without our FSA state agency directors. Any update on how that's coming and how soon we may see those folks put in place?
Well, that process is evolving. We've had a tranche of folks announced today in those categories, and a group that's either today or tomorrow. A group that was announced recently. I think what you're going to see over the next 30 to 45 days is a significant number of those positions being identified. Part of the challenge here is that we are competing, obviously, with other agencies who also are interested in having their people in place. And there is a very extensive vetting process that goes through to make sure that the people that are put in these positions don't have anything that would that would create some difficulty or challenge in terms of their ability to do the job and their ability to make sure that people have full faith and confidence in their ability to do the job. So we just have to let that vetting process go through the process. It does take some time, and that's because there are literally thousands of these jobs that have to be filled. You know, I'm excited about the fact that we're finally getting some folks on board, and I would anticipate South Dakota will see activity very soon.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, how are you doing? Good to see you again. Thanks for joining us. Fabulous. Hey, Farm Beam. How's it going? You know what questions I want to start with, but instead I'll stay on task kind of along the employee side of things with the mandatory vaccination. I know you've addressed it before. Your USDA offices all across the United States have to comply, including county directors. What kind of feedback are you hearing? I know that you mentioned last time around you had 4,000 more employees than what you're dealing with right now. Any concerns about implementation of programs? And again, good to see you.
Pam, thanks for the question. And I certainly understand the importance of the question because people obviously are concerned about making sure that the services that are provided in these offices are provided and not disrupted. I would say at the outset, the single most significant potential disruptor of farm service activities is COVID. And that's why it's important for folks, in our view, to get vaccinated. The USDA has done a survey of its employees. And it's asked its employees to basically certify that they have been vaccinated. A single vaccination by November 8th. Double vaccinated by November 22nd. We are still getting responses to those surveys in, but I can tell you that I am very pleased with the level of cooperation and involvement by our full-time employees at USDA across all mission areas, including FSA. And I can also tell you with some very high level of confidence that the rates of vaccination compare very favorably to the rates of vaccinations across the general population. I can also tell you that we continue to see a surge of people getting vaccinated. So those numbers by November 22nd are going to be even higher than they are today. And so I'm very confident that we're going to be able to continue to do the good work that I alluded to earlier in terms of the amount of activity that has to take place in those offices. There may very well be at some point in time a situation or circumstance in a particular office, after all, we've got several thousand of them, where there may be a challenge for whatever reason. Maybe it's pandemic COVID related. But I can tell you that in that event, we are basically preparing for the ability to surge capacity to offices that may be negatively impacted by the virus or by retirements or by the fact that some people make the choice not to be vaccinated. And so I'm at this point in time, I don't have any concern. I'm not losing sleep at this point on our ability to get the job done, even though the level of the amount of work that we are required to do, given the current normal ordinary course of business, given the American Rescue Plan responsibilities, given the new infrastructure bill that was passed, and given the possibility that we may have additional resources, significant resources, as a result of the Build Back Better proposal, I'm confident we're going to be able to get the job done. I just have an extraordinary amount of admiration and respect for the people who work for USDA. They are doers, they are problem solvers, they are not complainers, and they have stepped up and continue to step up.
Next question.
Good afternoon, Secretary. I'm student member Jenny Watts from WKDZ through WHVO radio station in Katy's, Kentucky. My question is, what are you doing to encourage the youth of today to participate in more agricultural activities and in the future work in agricultural communication jobs?
I think I got most of that question. I think you're asking what we're doing to encourage young people to get involved in agriculture and specifically ag communications.
Yes, sir.
Well, I can tell you that one of the things that we're doing is making sure that we are investing in talent development by investing in a wide range of capacity building efforts across land-grant universities and also minority-serving institutions. We are seeing an increase in investment in capacity building at land-grant universities, as well as an increased investment in minority-serving institutions, historic black colleges, universities, tribal colleges, and Hispanic-serving institutions. We're looking at the opportunity to expand significantly the amount of scholarships and fellowships that we're able to provide and internships we're able to provide at USDA in order to create that pipeline of young people coming into USDA and having experience in one of the mission areas, including communications, to determine how they might want to proceed with the rest of their college experience and what kind of opportunities, what kind of job opportunities they may seek in agriculture. We are also investing a significant amount of additional resource in beginning farmer and rancher programs. We recently, NIFA recently announced a $38 million investment in expanded farmer, beginning farmer and rancher efforts. And we're also taking a look at ways in which we can expand significantly the technical assistance to historically underserved producers, but also to beginning farmers. The American Rescue Plan directed us to invest in resources in that effort. And I think you'll see very shortly an initial investment in a number of organizations who will be utilizing their outreach efforts to connect to veterans, to connect to beginning farmers, to connect to minority farmers, to enable them to make sure that they understand fully and completely the programs that are available should they be interested in an agriculture career. The last thing I would say is we're also beginning to address the need for more extensive work in our cities. There's, a expanded opportunity to encourage and to connect people to agriculture through urban agriculture. And we are now in the process of expanding significantly our urban agriculture initiative into a number of major cities with planning and implementation grants that have been awarded. So there's a lot of activity across the board to get people excited. And I think, I just got back from COP26. And where agriculture played a role, but not a prominent role, and certainly not as open a role as some of the other areas of industry, I think you're going to see that change over the course of the next two COPs one of which is in Egypt, and I think the other one's going to be in the United Arab Emirates. I think there's going to be, interestingly enough, a real focus on agriculture at COP27 and COP28. And I think as that happens and as the world talks about the opportunities that agriculture has to be part of the solution of climate, I think you're going to see a lot more young people express interest.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Agromayora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlante, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlante's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlante today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplante.com.
Welcome back. Former Senator Pat Roberts attended the session with us farm broadcasters and Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. He had this exchange with the Secretary.
Ms. Secretary, my name is Pat Roberts. I'm not taking
a question from that guy. He's not a broadcaster. No,
well, I'm representing, not myself, but I'm reporting for WIBW and Topeka KFRM from Salina. KJNO from Dodge City and K-Man out of Manhattan, home of the ever optimistic and fighting Wildcats. Tom, I'm sorry about your back. I wish you well. I got the same problem. You might want to try one of these cinches. But we got to get together and figure out if our doctors are recommending the same thing. But I have a question about exports. I note that the president had the opportunity to have a Zoom call with President Xi. A lot of us in Ag were wondering about the extension of that first tranche that we had before that they really haven't used up yet. And an extension of that, as you know, it runs out in December. That's $80 billion worth of exports to a country that's not behaving itself. I understand that. But when you do that, they are dependent on us for a lot of what they need. Would you have a comment, sir?
Sure. Well, first of all, it's really great to hear from you, Senator and Mr. Chairman. Always considered you a friend and really appreciated working with you. Very few people working in the United States Senate in the history of the Senate have cared more deeply about farmers, ranchers, and producers than the man that's with you today, Pat Roberts. So
I'm appearing tomorrow with you. Colin Peterson. You might think about inviting Colin and me back over for another steak dinner, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, that would... That's not a bad idea, actually. That's a very good idea.
We're now free to say anything, any damn thing we want. Colin. You know, Colin does that anyway, but I'm interrupting you, sir. Go ahead, please. Well. Thank you. And thank you for all
on
those
the export side, I think right now the focus on the China-U.S. relationship as it relates to agriculture is strongly indicating to the Chinese that we are not satisfied. with the level of activity or implementation of phase one. We're not satisfied because the Chinese made on the phytosanitary and sanitary side of that deal, they made 57 commitments. Now, it is true that they have complied with 50 of them, but there are seven that are still outstanding, a number of which are really important, not the least of which are commitments on more quickly approving biotechnology events for use in China. There was a biofuel commitment that that needs to be committed to. So there are a variety of things that need to be done on that side in order for us to be more satisfied with phase one. Secondly, while it is true that the Chinese resumed purchases from the U.S., they have not yet reached the level of purchase to be fully compliant with phase one's level at promised level. And it's a little tricky because when you see the numbers, you think, whoa, boy, this is a lot of money that they're spending, a lot of stuff they're buying. But then you need to take a step back and ask the question, how much of their overall purchasing is represented by the purchases being made from the U.S.? And what we find, interestingly enough, is while they are spending more money and buying more of our product, our market share of what is being purchased has been reduced. So the Chinese are purchasing not because they are complying with phase one, but they're purchasing because they see a need to purchase, and they have purchased more from the rest of the world. So that's why I think it's important for us to say very, very forcefully, you have to comply with phase one in its fullest extent for us to have any conversation about any other aspect of our relationship. Because if you don't do phase one, how can you trust them to do anything else?
Secondly, as you well know,
and better than just about anybody, this is a complicated relationship we have with China. On the one hand, we seek cooperation and need cooperation on issues like climate, on issues like the pandemic, on issues like cybersecurity. On the other hand, there are areas where there are serious differences of opinion, not the least of which is the South China Sea, the South and North Korea, Hong Kong, way in which they
Taiwan.
Treat minority populations. Yeah. And so it's important for us to understand the complexity of this relationship and try to make sure that we are able to maintain what is working and make it work better and fix what's not working.
Well, thank you for that comprehensive thing. I have one other thing to thank you for. You've just nominated Ms. Jacob Young to head up the ARS. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I think
and she got her hearing yesterday, I think.
She's been
today or yesterday.
She's been there for quite some time, has a great deal of experience. I hope the Ag Committee can give her a good solid vote. We can get her on board because she needs to come out to Kansas State and tour NBAF, and we get that finally completed. Tom, thank you for what you're doing. I appreciate it. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Pat.
Thank you, Senator. Next question, please.
Good afternoon, Secretary Vilsack, Mark Dorenkamp, Brownfield Ag Network, Clear Lake, Iowa. Just curious what could be done under the purview of USDA to help farmers who are facing rapidly escalating input costs for next year?
Well, we are in the process of taking a look at ways in which we can use some of the capacity under the Commodity Credit Corporation to address those issues. This is a relatively complicated problem. And part of it has to do with the fact that there is significant global demand that essentially came online more quickly than the supply chain generally was capable of handling. During the pandemic, everything shut down. People made adjustments. The supply chain made adjustments to a new reality. Then, as the pandemic as got some relief from the pandemic, things opened up very quickly, more quickly than the supply chain was prepared for, and that has created some serious issues. We continue to work with transportation, with the Maritime Commission,
and others to make sure that that we're addressing the issue of our ports. To the extent that we can get a product that's in the harbor, if you will, off the ship, off the container ship, onto a truck, and get it to its ultimate destination, that can be that would be helpful. So, two things: one, we're looking at hours of service and operation, encouraging the ports to go to 24/7 operation, 7 days a week. Which they have agreed to do, at least on the West Coast, they've agreed to do that, which should help. Two, utilizing resources to create a sort of a movement, if you will, of product. One of the issues is that containers are now stacked up at the port because we have fewer truck drivers. And the reason we have fewer truck drivers is because people, as you know, a historic number of people have decided to retire all at one time. And so we're in the position of having to try to figure out creative ways to move product off of the port to make room for moving the containers off the ships. So, for example, in Savannah, we're looking at ways in which we can create sort of a mini port, if you will, several hundred miles away from the current port, to be able to move product, and that would create a quicker flow of product. Part of it has to do longer term, I think, as well, with taking a look at ways in which we can, through research, significantly reduce the need for inputs. And let me give you one example. I was recently with the Secretary of Agriculture of Mexico at Iowa State University, and we had a chance to visit their plant science area. And I was amazed, and I think he was too, about work that's being done with sensors to take a look at how much fertilizer is actually necessary and required to be applied to corn acres. There's a sensor that they're developing that essentially you plug in, if you will, or stick into a corn stalk, and it can read whether or not that particular stalk requires to be fertilized. Now, from their research, they are operating under the hypothesis that perhaps as much as a third of the corn acres in this country, which are currently being fertilized, really don't require any fertilization at all, So as we become more precise with inputs, while this is not a specific response to today's supply chain challenges and costs, it is a response longer term and a more permanent response, if you will, by suggesting that the more precise we are with inputs, the less inputs we need, which means that the farmers are not, their bottom line isn't impacted or affected adversely. The last thing I would say, and this is this is difficult for farmers to, and for all of us to get our arms around, but as you look at the high cost of inputs, you can't just look at the high cost of inputs. You also have to look at the impact of those inputs. Do they, in fact, significantly increase yields? Do they significantly impact the quality of whatever is being grown and raised? And if so, does that translate into more revenue, more value? And does that help in some way to offset the higher costs? I will tell you that I was a little concerned about a quote that was attributed to one of our seed company the other day in the Wall Street Journal, where they indicated that they were very pleased with the fact that their costs were going up because they were able to raise prices high enough to offset those costs and then some. And I thought to myself, well, geez, you guys really shouldn't be taking advantage of this circumstance in terms of putting too much of a burden on the farmer. You shouldn't be making sure that you're being fair. And I think that gets us back to this whole conversation about consolidation and whether or not, we've got enough competition to make it so that folks don't take advantage of a circumstance and situation. The president recently suggested the FTC take a look at the oil industry, and what do you know, almost instantaneously, gas prices are coming down. So it's, there's a lot of there, and we're working on a variety of aspects to it.
Thanks, Secretary, and wish you a speedy recovery.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Thank you, Secretary Vilsack, DeLoss Yonke, Illinois Farm Bureau, RFD Radio Network. I saw on Twitter today, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and U.S. Department of Army announced the proposed rule to reestablish the pre-2015 definition of WOTUS. Did USDA collaborate with that? I imagine you have seen that rule. Do you have any comment on what would have been announced today?
I've not had a chance to see the final version. We obviously collaborate from the perspective of making sure that EPA understands the necessity of outreach, understanding the necessity of listening to those who are impacted and affected by it. And I think while it is not a total recraft or redraft of a previous rule, I think it also takes into consideration the Supreme Court decision, which makes it a little bit different than either the Trump rule or the Obama rule. And obviously, folks are going to have the opportunity to weigh in on this. You know, our challenge and our job will be to work with producers as they take a look at what they may have to do or not have to do based on compliance and figure out ways in which we can use the tools at USDA to make it easier for them to comply.
Next question.
Mr. Secretary, I'm John Gooding, WGFA in Watseka, Illinois. Your administration talks a lot about climate change. We had E15, now we're back to E10. We can't get the blending requirements. Could you tell me a little bit what you see about our renewable fuels' role in climate change?
Well, it's an incredibly important role because I think you're going to see the industry continue to invest in lowering its carbon footprint. And the reality of our transportation system is that we're going to continue to need biofuel. And I think you're going to continue to see support for that. You're going to see it in a number of different ways. You're going to see it in resources that will be provided to the industry to reflect the concerns and issues that they had relative to COVID. I think you're going to see it when the Build Back Better bill passes the Congress. There are additional resources allocated and directed to the biofuel industry in that bill to complement what USDA is already committed to providing. I think you're going to see it in the certainty of the RVOs that basically the EPA puts out. I think in the past what you had was a circumstance where the previous administration set a number, but that number, you could never trust it because there were waivers being granted in a very significant way, in a very large way, which significantly reduced that number over time, so you could never trust it. I think what you're going to see from the EPA, based on the statements Administrator Reagan has made, is that when they fix the number, they're not going to provide a lot of waivers in the way in which the previous administration did. And I think you're also going to see this administration investing a significant amount of resource in helping to develop new industries connected to the biofuel industry. In other words, are there new ways in which we can create additional market opportunities for the industry? And I think one market opportunity is the notion of aviation fuel. I jokingly say, it's one thing if the battery in an electric car goes down, you can pull off the side of the road, get your cell phone, and you can get help right away. It's another thing if you're flying across the Atlantic Ocean or Pacific Ocean in an airplane and the battery goes down. And so I think you're going to continue to see the need for aviation fuel and a real desire on the part of the aviation industry to have a biofuel 100% drop-in, not a blended fuel, but 100% drop-in. I think you're going to see a commitment of billions of dollars to try to create by 2030, 3 billion gallon opportunity, and that expanded significantly, ultimately to a 36 billion gallon annual opportunity. Now, that's a pretty significant number when you take a look at the current industry. And I think you're also going to see efforts by this administration to provide additional resources to expand the capacity of consumers to access E15 and higher blends in the near future. So I think there's a number of ways in which this industry is going to be helped and a number of ways in which this administration is going to try to advance it. You know, the fact is that that it's an existing industry. It's a more mature industry. And so it won't necessarily get as much attention as an electric car, which is a new industry. Just in the same way that 20, 25 years ago, it was a relatively new industry, and it got a lot of attention with the RFS being passed and ways in which the industry has helped. And so, you know, I think this is we're striking a good balance here. We're going to continue to need the biofuel for cars and trucks. We're going to continue to advance ways in which we can expand consumer choice. And we're also going to provide additional financial support for the industry. We're going to provide certainty in the market. And we're also going to work with the industry to create this new opportunity with aviation fuel and marine fuel. So I think things are going to be pretty good in the industry over the course of the next several years.
Next question.
Mr. Vilsack, Kara Hart, Red River Farm Radio Network, out of Grand Forks, North Dakota. Thank you for taking my question. My question for you is, what is the timeline for implementing the new 2020-2021 WIP Plus and disaster programs authorized by the September continuing resolution? Thank you.
We're taking a look at potentially a two-step process here. To the extent that this $10 billion of investment that the Congress has directed us to make can be funneled through existing programs and funneled with existing data, we will try to get that done relatively quickly. And by this, I mean to the extent that we have those producers who have crop insurance, who have filed crop insurance claims, we have their data, we know their losses, we know the extent of their the challenge that they face, and we should be able to use that information without having them go through a very elaborate process, if you will, of reapplying. The same thing would be true with the LFP program on the livestock side, if we can utilize the data that exists in that program to assist those farmers. However, there are farmers who either didn't have crop insurance or didn't have the non-crop insurance assistance program resources or had shallow losses. And so those folks, it may require us to go through a more detailed process to create a structure by which they can also take advantage of the resources available. So with this two-step process, one can envision a circumstance where we establish a framework at the end of this year, early part of next year, with the idea that some producers will be able to access those resources perhaps as early as February. And then perhaps a smaller number because they didn't have crop insurance or they have to provide the data, they have to provide the information to be able to justify a payment. That may take a little bit longer. And that's basically what we advised Senator Hovind and Senator Baldwin earlier this week when we visited. And I think they were pleased with the structure and were encouraged by the timeline.
Let's give Secretary of Agriculture from the NAFB a nice round of applause for being with us today. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you all very much. I hope you enjoy the convention, and hopefully next year I can be there in person. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
That's our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Crew. Thanks for listening.